Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We open hour two of the program with the Dakota Political Junkies. It's Wednesday. It's noon. Today we welcome Denise Ross and Seth Tupper. Denise, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Seth, thanks for being here as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Big stuff going on today. The Initiative and Referendum Task Force underway. Denise, they're arguing about whether it's time to reform the process, whether there's voter fatigue, whether it's because of the dominance of the Republican Party in the state. Does all this have validity?
And you're talking about the proposed ballot measure to mm-hmm. limit out-of-state funds? Yeah. I think it's legislator fatigue of having to deal with ideas that didn't come from a legislator, and they don't like things they can't control so well, is my impression. My first just gut instinct is that I don't think voters will approve this measure. I think they'll see it for what it is, as an attempt to limit initiatives and their opportunity to record their voice on different matters. And I think you've seen very sophisticated voter behavior, especially in 2016 we had a lot of complicated ballot measures, and they were not uniform in their voting. They voted strongly for some, strongly against for others. And by personal experience, just with my own family and friend circle, people really want to understand what they're voting on. And because of the line of work I've been in, they come to me and ask questions about what does this mean, what does that mean. And I know other reporters who've had similar experience. So my initial thought is that it's probably not going to pass, but we'll see what happens.
Seth, thoughts on citizen democracy and whether or not the dominance of the state GOP in peer really makes a difference or not? Is that legitimate?
I think it does. I mean, if you notice, a lot of politicians in the state didn't really seem to have a problem with out-of-state money and ballot issues until that out-of-state money started coming from more liberal-leaning organizations that were trying to support ballot issues that would maybe crack down on that Republican dominance and create different bodies and ethics groups, things like that, and nonpartisan elections and redistricting and independent redistricting groups and things of that nature. And when it became somewhat of a threat, that's when you notice that a lot of Republican politicians said, hey, what's all this out-of-state money doing in our ballot issues? So I think there's, it's inescapable that politics is mixed up in all of it. But I think there also is some legitimate concern, too, that, over somebody from out of state has an idea that they want to spread across the country, and it's cheap to start it in South Dakota, and if they can dump millions of dollars in here, they can maybe get it passed. And I think most people would say that's probably not, the greatest use of the ballot box. So right. Beyond the politics, I think there's some legitimate concern there as well.
So my question is, does something such as an initiated Measure 22 not make it on the ballot without outside money, or does it just heat up the conversation and is helped, being pushed one way or the other because of the outside money? Marcy's Law doesn't get on the ballot then without outside money, or is it just not advertised as much without outside money?
Well, I think there's no question that Marcy's Law would not have been on the ballot without outside money. That was one guy's idea, a billionaire from California, and he hired people to get that on the ballot in South Dakota, and they paid petition circulators to gather the petitions. It wasn't something that anybody in South Dakota proposed, and yet it was on our ballot. So I don't think there's any question that would not have even come up without outside money. Other ones, IM-22, it certainly benefited from outside money, but if somebody was really, committed to getting that on the ballot here, certainly they could have done that. But that's one thing that a lot of people don't realize, is that how many of these ballot issues, how many of the signatures are gathered by paid signature collectors. Mm. And that has really changed the game, I think, in that anybody with enough resources now can say, hey, I'll just pay some company to send an army of people out there and gather up the petition signatures, and we'll get something on the ballot. If that ability wasn't there, you'd see a lot less things on the ballot, I think, not only from out of state, but from in state. And, but when it's that easy to get something on the ballot, if you have the resources, it just becomes, very easy and convenient.
All right. Denise, any final thoughts on that and this whole conversation about out-of-state money and citizen democracy, or will you leave it there?
Only that in the Argus Leader article, I can't remember exactly who said, but they think it's not constitutional because the Supreme Court has already ruled that political money equals speech. So I think that would be another hurdle that if this were to pass, I would see a challenge in the courts, and then that would be another hurdle they'd have to clear.
Interesting. All right, speaking of courts, a judge announces President Trump will not be a defendant in a lawsuit regarding the Dakota Access Pipeline. Denise, what does that sort of reveal about the politics of this conversation that President Trump himself would be named or not named in a lawsuit?
You know what? I don't think it reveals anything political. It's purely procedural by the courts. The executive of the United States, a whole lot of people try to sue the president, and I'm not a lawyer or a judge, so I can't tell you exactly where these lines are drawn, but there are some pretty clear lines about when you can enjoin the executive and when you can't. And I think it's natural that they would take a run at that, but I also think I wasn't at all surprised. I didn't hear anything leading up to it, but when I heard the report that said the judge isn't going to allow it, it didn't mean much to me. I don't think that affects the outcome either, really.
Sure. So from all the way to the highest office in the land, down to the city level and billboards and these little details that we end up sort of hashing out. Denise, you want to give me an overview of the billboard drama in Rapid City?
It's as old as probably billboards themselves.
Really?
Out here,
start from the beginning, but put it in context for people who don't live there and don't know the whole history.
And I can't remember how many years ago there was a group, local group, in fact, it's back to these ballot initiatives, this was a true local initiative, who really got together and did a whole lot of work to limit billboards, the size, the number you could have. I haven't studied this issue in detail, but I happen to be at a couple different city council meetings, and I remember this, how close they could be to buildings, how many you could have on your property. Like some of these downtown businesses will have billboards downtown.
Sure.
It was about the time that these digital billboards were coming in, where you're driving down the main thoroughfares and you're seeing all this movement on the signs. So they got together and passed on the ballot an ordinance that the public supported, and right away you had the sign companies promising to file suit. I read the journal article correctly, there were two different lawsuits filed. Again, not totally familiar with all of the details, but apparently the folks at the city came up with some kind of a settlement, and the city council initially balked. Now, one of the people who worked really, really hard to get that issue on the ballot and pass it, named Lisa Modric, she's now on the city council, so she has a whole lot of influence on how this is going to go and a whole lot of investment in it and knowledge of the details. You know, how many square feet is a billboard and how tall can it be and how, you know, all that stuff is kind of mundane and will make your eyes glaze over, but she's very well versed in it. So I think you're going to see a protracted conversation. I will add, I don't know if you were going to get to this, another quote-unquote settlement that happened was with the developers of this, what was to be a very elaborate downtown development, a high-rise tower with shopping and residences and everything. It was President's Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a parking lot that for I don't know how many years back mayors have been trying to get some development in there. And the city sort of volunteered to give them over $360,000 back, these developers, or the deal fell apart for the work they had put into it. Anyway, that is what's really generating a lot more local conversation around here than the billboard sign. I think there's certain people who are invested in that fight. I don't hear a lot of talk among the rank and file folks on that one. It's the other deal that's really getting people exercised.
So was there a lawsuit with the development there that the city was settling?
There was not a lawsuit. They never filed a lawsuit. So that's why I say the city just sort of volunteered to give their money back. It was a deal. It's complicated, but it was a deal where they were proposing to get what's called New Market Tax Credits, the federal program, and the former mayor, Sam Quaker, had started questioning this. It was going to be millions of dollars that they were going to bring into the project with this tax credit program, and he basically discovered that they had not applied for these tax credits. They had not attended meetings they needed to go to get be involved in this process, And I happened to, again, be at a city council meeting where one of the developers was there answering questions to this effect. And so that's sort of what led to the deal falling apart. And now the current administration at City Hall is blaming the old mayor for this deal. And they're basically saying he left us no choice but to pay these guys hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxpayer money. And it's, people are pretty worked up about it.
Seth, what did we miss in that? What are sort of the significance, with billboards, with the development, with money going back and forth that you wanted to add to the conversation?
Not much. It's just kind of, both of them are just this age-old question of, how much should government be involved in business and regulating business, and of course, in an area where there's a lot of conservative people politically, like in the Black Hills, that's a really hot-button issue, and that was really at the heart, I think, of this President's Plaza debate here in Rapid City was, should the developers, who many people would argue don't need any help, should they be getting tax credits from the government or should they not? And,
sure.
And that just became, a real hot button, and it had a lot of ramifications for the last mayor's race here in Rapid City, and will continue to be a big issue, I'm sure.
All right. If you go to rapidcityjournal.com, you can see a piece by Seth on bentonite, and we're going to keep talking about taxes. So I haven't read this yet, Seth. Give me an idea what bentonite even is.
Well, bentonite was thought to be the product of volcanic ash that was in the atmosphere millions of years ago and settled into a giant inland sea on the continent. Uh-huh. And through chemical changes over the millennia, basically, it became this very absorbent and useful clay that is mined for use in cat litter. And it's also used in a lot of other products, used in castings, as I understand it, the molds that are used to make metal castings and things like that. So, they've been mining bentonite in South Dakota since the 1920s and also in Wyoming and Montana. And I was looking into a permit that's been applied for to open up a new area for bentonite mining northwest of Belle Fourche, where there's already a lot of mining, but this would be additional mining. And severance taxes were on my mind because we'd done some reporting recently about gold mining in the Black Hills and saw that Wharf Resources and others who mine gold have to pay a severance tax based on the value of the gold that they pull out of the ground every year. Hmm. And so I just started looking into, is there anything similar for bentonite? And it turns out there is not. Even though in South Dakota we have a severance tax on the mining of gold, silver, uranium, thorium, petroleum, natural gas, a lot of other mined commodities, but yet this bentonite, which can be worth millions and millions of dollars, we do not tax. And furthermore, Wyoming and Montana do tax bentonite.
Really? And it's been being mined since the 1920s in South Dakota.
Exactly. And I wasn't able to find out if we ever did tax it. I wasn't able to get anybody that had the history on that, and if maybe we just repealed the tax, but we don't now. And Wyoming and Montana do, and they make a few million dollars a year for state and local governments off it.
Sure. Did you dig up anything that kind of gave you an indication of why?
The only theory that anybody had, everybody I interviewed for this was kind of just, never really considered
right.
that before, was their response. The only thing they could offer as a theory was that in South Dakota, people tend to think of bentonite more like just a useful gumbo clay or like sand or gravel.
Sure.
And so maybe when the severance taxes were adopted, they distinguished that from gold and silver and things like that. But, I don't know too many gravel pits that are owned by a $2 billion publicly traded company based in New York.
Right.
Like the bentonite, American Colloid is a principal miner of bentonite in South Dakota, and that's their corporate ownership is worth that much. So while it strikes a lot of people as just this kind of useful, clay in the ground, it's a valuable commodity, and there's a big market for it, and it's big business.
And you can read the whole story at rapidcityjournal.com from Seth Tupper. They're always doing great work, Seth. And let's finish up the group, Denise and Seth, with a little bit about Muslim groups and Christian groups and some of the conversations that are happening West River in Rapid City as churches sort of try to figure out how to have conversations and other groups protest and wonder, who should be leading those conversations, et cetera. How big of a deal is this in Rapid City? Is it just kind of off to the side, or is it starting to gain traction as something folks are talking about, Denise?
Well, I apologize. I am not up to speed on this issue, so maybe I better kick it over to Seth and see if he knows anything about it. I would say initially that my thought is the whole Native American white conversation is more prominent here, but sure. Maybe I missed something that happened recently.
Seth, thoughts on Muslim groups and the state GOP?
It's flared up recently because, I don't know, a couple months ago, the same weekend as the Pennington County Republican Lincoln Day dinner here, the Family Heritage Alliance and some other, which is a conservative political group here in Rapid City, based in Rapid City, and some other groups hosted speakers who, on what they called, radical Islamic extremism or terrorism. And it was, the people that came, some people view those as hate groups. Other people view them as just anti-terrorism, anti-radical extremism groups. And there was a lot of conversation around that, around the fact that politicians such as Marty Jackley and Chantel Krebs had popped into that presentation and then kind of popped out of it. And then there was another presentation here recently, just last week, I believe, very similar presentation. There were some people who gathered to protest it. I wouldn't say it's on the radar of your average everyday person in Rapid City, but it's certainly, something that's happened, and people that are paying attention to it have very, very strong passions about it. And it's just sort of this ongoing question about, where do you cross the line when you're talking about radical extremism and terrorism? Where do you cross the line into just being anti-Muslim and painting everybody with too broad of a brush? And that's sort of the back and forth that's going on here now.
And probably across the state as well to a certain extent. Seth Tupper, Denise Ross, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lori.
Yep, you're welcome.